Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Tony Trujillo. Tony Trujillo's newest books are White Noise, from Apostrophe Books, forthcoming 2013, and Historic Diary, from Blaise Vox Books, 2011. His poems have appeared recently in the anthologies The Arcadia Project, North American Postmodern Pastoral, from Asada Press, 2012, and City of the Big Shoulders, an anthology of Chicago poetry, University of Iowa Press, 2012. He directs the Creative Writing Poetry Program at Columbia College Chicago and co-edits the poetry journal Court Green. Hi, Tony. How are you?
Great, Jan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're really happy that you're in Pittsburgh, and you're going to read from your new book, Historic Diary.
Yes, I'm going to read poems from Historic Diary.
Okay.
And just a couple words about the book. It's based on the diary that alleged Kennedy assassin Lee Harvey Oswald kept when he was in the Soviet Union from 1959 to 1962. And he called his diary Historic Diary, so that became the title of the book. And the poems are really triggered by the diary itself, but then they go beyond just the diary and trying to sort of explore the myths and texts of Lee Harvey Oswald and his psyche. The first poem I'm going to read is called Crouched at the Walker Estate. It's one of the early poems in the book, and takes place in Dallas. Oswald, it's in April of 1963, about 7 months before the assassination. And this is one important moment in his life where he makes an assassination attempt on General Walker, who was a very widely known, deeply right-wing figure in Dallas and around the nation at the time. So this poem is the moment right before. Crouched at the Walker Estate. I'm no unskilled laborer. I came to the Soviet Union to study philosophy. Please, let me show you some Southern manners. Rich men walk with a drawl through living rooms, unconscious of their bodies. Rich men rise to meet them. Evacuate all thoughts. Send them street level. We have ladders for that, hidden in the subways. The temperature at the plant reached 140 on the ceiling. That's what triggered the sprinklers. We made ventilators for attics. They trained me to be a sheet metal man if I stuck around. I paid a stenographer to type my manuscript. I learned photo printing, to agitate light. I blew up pictures, made leaflets and identification. What good is a mound of dry wood, logs laid in a circle? I'm the one who knows how to strike a match. My friend de Morenschild would be proud. This kind of talk impresses him. A living room, cold drinks, some fluster of politics, hands waving against something out the window. No one's really looking. I'm in a corner. I used to think in words, their accretions, spells, spelling. Moths wrestle the fog. I can't stop my eyes swaying every time I'm introduced to someone who wants to talk politics. Yes, I lived there. I was a radio checker. Everyone was a communist. My father sold insurance. Is that skilled labor at someone's kitchen table, cups of their coffee, reaching inside their bodies like a dog catcher? My brother drives a milk truck. Someone's always renting my mother money. Walker's in his study doing his taxes. Now's the chance. This next poem is called I Locked Him in the Bathroom to Stop Him from Seeing Richard Nixon. And it's in Marina Oswald's voice, Lee Harvey Oswald's wife. A lot of the information that triggered the poem for me came from the transcripts of an FBI interview with Marina Oswald, but really the poem was made possible when I was in Dallas doing some research, and the person who lived in the Oswald's old apartment on Neely Street showed me around the apartment, and I could physically get a sense of the place, and that actually helped me write about it. I locked him in the bathroom to stop him from seeing Richard Nixon, Marina Oswald. This was one time he did what I wanted. He could break down the door, his strength against mine. I told him if he wanted to leave the bathroom, he'd have to walk across my body. He must promise not to shoot at other people. He said Nixon's coming and he just wanted to take a look. But I know how he looks after he went to Turtle Creek and with that rifle to kill General Walker. I held the knob, braced my foot against the wall in the hallway. He was not going to shoot anyone else. He promised after Walker. I held on hard, but it's a cheap door. The knob shook in my hand like it was stuck in butter. He could have opened it with his full strength. I was afraid something might happen to the baby. He gave his word that he'd undress, give me his clothes and pistol, and stay in the bathroom all day. The shoes, too. He sat on the toilet for 3 hours. I guess he was reading. When I allowed him to come out, he brought a book into the living room and read in his underwear. He took the gun back from beneath the mattress where I hid it, returned it to the top shelf in his study, the closet by our front door. I kept him in the house all day by persuasion. We never talked about Nixon again. As I said, the diary covers Oswald's time in the Soviet Union. He and Marina come back to the States in 1962, and those first couple poems were of that time period. There's a mystery period for Lee Harvey Oswald in September of 1963, a couple of months before the assassination, where he takes a trip to Mexico City, allegedly to get a visa to go back to the Soviet Union. And this poem deals with that mystery trip. Oswald in Mexico. Last night, I dreamed I had insomnia. That a woman with pregnancy privileges, Marina, meaning her feet could go anywhere she wanted, put her swollen ankle on my leg. I had to kick her off. I had plans. I wandered. Walked through two living rooms till I found the back door to the alley. Mother was there, keeping an eye on June Lee. I told her I hang diapers on the line because Marina's too tired, pregnant with Rachel, to get out of bed. She was proud, finally, so I got the nerve to confess. My mother, my love, I first read the Communist Manifesto and first volume of Capital in 1954 when I was 15. I have studied 18th century philosophers, works by Lenin, and after 1959 attended numerous Marxist reading circles at the factory where I worked. Some were compulsory, and others were not. Marina heard everything. She wrote it down. There will be no Fidel in my body. I tried to talk them into giving me a visa for Cuba in Mexico City, but the KGB was playing a volleyball game that day with the GRU, like FBI versus CIA, and in their tight shorts and tennis shoes, they tried to get rid of me. I'd been awake all night. I went to a bullfight my last day there. It was Sunday. Inside, the animal is a street agitator and radio inspector. Even the banderilleros must listen to him in order to plant a flag in the bull's body just far enough so he gets tired of his own courage and goes limp.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Tony Trujillo. He's reading from his book, Historic Diary. You talked about this book as being triggered by diary myths and texts surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald. And Can you talk a little bit about the nature of this obsession? I mean, it seems large and deep, and I know that it went on for years. I mean, the writing of this book. Can you talk about maybe how it started or what forms it took?
Sort of the archaeology of it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, at its most basic, fundamental, root, emotional level, it goes back to something I missed, which was the assassination itself. I was born in 1966, so it was 3 years after the assassination. And as I was growing up, my mother and one of my brothers would talk about watching the television the day that Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald. And that was obviously an enormous and intense moment for them. And they would describe it to me, and they just wanted me to know what an important moment that was, like someone now talking about watching the towers fall on 9/11 and just how awful they felt and how big of a deal it was. And I internalized that and thought, oh, that was so big. I wish I would have experienced that with them. And not that I wanted someone to be killed, but just to experience the event. And so I think that itself triggered a deep interest in the assassination. I'm also, like many writers, a very political person. So I've always felt the assassination is sort of like a hinge point where our country just became a different kind of country after that. So that's another reason I've always been excited by it. And so I was always reading about the assassination, but it really became an idea for a writing project, a feeling for a writing project when I discovered Oswald had kept a diary. And just, you know, as writers, we just go straight to the diary and we think, oh, that I want to hear that self that was in the diary, and I wanted to hear that badly. And it resonated enough that poems just started coming from that, from the diary.
Mm-hmm. And you worked on the book for many years, is that correct?
Yeah, I could say that the short answer would be that I worked on it from about 2005, 2004 to 2008, you know, give or take a year or something, which is a long time. But even before that, about 10 years before that, I had made some efforts to do the book, to write the book. I had started and aborted poems based on the diary. I just wasn't ready to write the book or to take on a kind of project like this. But around 04, 05, especially I think 04, it just, the timing was right and I could do something like this.
Okay. Yeah, I want to ask you some more about that, but could you read a couple more poems?
Yes. The next poem I'm going to read is, it's a number of the poems are persona poems or dramatic monologues, as that last one was from Marina's perspective. This is from the voice of Lee Harvey Oswald's brother, Robert. And he's speaking after Oswald defected to the USSR in 1959, 4 years before the assassination. It's called Robert Oswald. A taxi cab braked next to me. At that time, you knew reporters by their short-sleeved shirts, loose ties. He held a sheet of paper torn from the AP wire machine, the Dallas-Fort Worth News, saying, Lee Harvey Oswald was defecting in Moscow. I couldn't believe it. I built myself a bustling milk route in Fort Worth. My truck was cold, refrigerated deliveries pretty new back then, blunt steel and glass, clean but nothing fancy. All I could think of, this hometown boy, my own brother, wearing those big fur hats like you saw in pictures of communists. I'd get used to reporters, but then I was just out of the service with a family, lucky for my route. Your kids never should feel like a burden. Mother set up a conference call the next week from the Fort Worth press offices, and we tried to reach him in Moscow. It took a while to connect. You know, overseas long distance was different in those days. But we got through the Metropole Hotel. Once he heard her voice, he left the phone dangling and walked away. She was so much like Lee, wanted to be somebody. This poem is it's called Arrival in USSR, and it's the experience of Oswald's arrival in the Soviet Union, and a little more specifically, he had applied for citizenship to be a Soviet citizen, and the application was denied, and then he tried to hurt himself. So this is called Arrival in USSR. The train from Helsinki. discharge papers, a gift from Rima at the Lenin-Stalin tomb, Idiot by Dostoevsky, stitches removed in the hospital, only after prolonged 2 hours observation of other patients, he realized it was the insanity ward. Dogs barrel rolling in the smell of rabbit grass, Rima by his side as interpreter. Told the doctors he couldn't eat the kasha. It was dry as gravel. Hospital water tasted wrung from moldy rags. To complain is a good sign, they told Rima. Later, they left. He was alone with Rima among the mentally ill. She encouraged and scolded him. The Soviets come at nightfall. Everyone looks at you a certain way. Mother's hot breath on his backside. Not this time. The balding, stout apparatchik tried to send him back to America 5 days ago. Not this time. The petty officials. Back in the bathtub, sticking himself. They know the world opened in afterglow on the train, blood smear in the sky, believe in omens, shirt collar soaked when he woke up, fire in the head.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Tony Trigilio. He's reading from his new book, Historic Diary. Tony, I wanted to ask you about the complications of inhabiting the voices of historical figures, and you know, especially those related to, you know, such a defining moment in U.S. history. And if were you afraid to enter any of that territory, or did you have, you know, misgivings, or how did you go about it?
I was terrified.
Okay.
Okay. And I had misgivings, and I was intensely curious. I went into it, and it was very important for me to write the book not really caring whether Lee Harvey Oswald had killed the president or not. I developed opinions as time went on, but it was, even those I put aside, it was really important to just think I'm writing about Oswald's psyche and being inside his head. But he was, whether or not he killed the president, he was a violent man, and he had a gigantic chip on his shoulder, maybe for good reason, maybe not, but he had a giant chip on his shoulder about the U.S. and about capitalism. And as I said, he was violent. So to be inside his head was to be inside a person who had been through really, really difficult times and maybe not come through on the other side very well. So yeah, it was scary. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of misgivings.
Mm-hmm. You know, I talked with you earlier about some of this, and you talked about experiential truth as opposed to literal historical truth. Can you talk about negotiating those two and how that came up in the writing of this?
Yeah, I had to, I'm thinking about the core of the poems had to have sort of two things simmering and colliding with each other. And one was that the fact stuff, the truth-telling stuff, had to be accurate. You know, I couldn't say that Oswald was in the Soviet Union in September 1963 or something, because that's just so historically wrong, you know. And it's, you know, I had to place him in Dallas the day of the assassination and so on. But then I also had to, hone in on an emotional truth. So there are times like, you know, in one of the poems, I have him confessing that he hit his wife. And the confession occurs when he's in the Soviet Union. But he never was confronted with that head on, by other people to the point where he had to confess. That never happened until he came back to the States. And the Russian expatriate community really took him to task and said, basically, you know, you can't hit your wife. And but given what else was going on in that particular poem, it just felt like I had to compress the fact-telling truth to get to the emotional truth. Mm-hmm. That in the Soviet Union, that's where the fact that he was abusing his wife was going to just really start to weigh heavily on him. So that's one example. There are other moments when I did that, but I was always obsessed with making sure that I didn't get the facts wrong. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And it sounds like that the emotional truth was served always also.
I hope that comes out the way. That was my feeling, that when one of the people I interviewed for the book So there was book research and online research and movie research and then personal interviews and oral histories. And I interviewed Ruth Payne, the woman with whom Marina lived the day of the assassination. And I mentioned this in the notes to the book, how she was getting a little agitated by some of my questions. And I understood that. And I asked her about it. And she said, no, this is fine. I can do this. It takes a toll. But I really want to give you this interview because you're telling the emotional history of the assassination. And that was one of my guiding compasses. Like, I'm telling the emotional history. That's right. And that's what a poem can do and should do.
Okay. Could you read some more?
This one is called Oswald to His Father. Oswald's father died when his mother was 7 months pregnant with him, and he never knew his father. But I had to write about that big, gaping lack in his life. So I decided to make it in the form of a letter from Oswald to his father. And this is the poem I was mentioning. I had to play with a little bit of factual truth-telling to get the historical truth, to get the emotional truth right. Oswald to his father. I hit Marina. Can't help it, the way she holds the baby. When the pacifier falls on the floor, she cleans it with her mouth. She can't see the drift of microbes. The floors are dirty and must be washed every day. They tell me you sold insurance. You know what I mean. If you keep things clean, you don't need to gamble with a premium, a briefcase, some rickety box of soul we call property. I could not tell Mother about my plans because she could hardly be expected to understand. Say something, Father, to give me back the moonlight from the rafters. When they told me about you, I was a burst tub gashed with an axe, sweet beer sloshing. They said you died 2 months before I was born, a safe, virtuous desertion. I'd spell out what I mean for you if I could. Let me put it this way. I'm supposed to believe this world was made by a father who turned one son against the other over slaughtered sheep and a bundle of hay? No. We've made it here. At night, we watch the Sivashlok River from the balcony, grazing the green banks of Kalinina Street. It's February in Minsk, but I'm so sweaty I'd like to grab a rocking chair for a breeze. I feel like an old man. Marina's eye is black. Junie's crying. I'm going to read a couple poems from the last section of the book. The last section I try to get at, this apocryphal story in Kennedy assassination research that over 100 people, witnesses to the assassination, died mysteriously. And I researched them all. That seemed like a really high amount. But it turned out there were 25 very suspicious ones. So I wrote about these in separate poems. And almost all of the poems have a counting form so that there's the same number of words in each line so that the conspiracy wildness kind of butts up against the discipline of the form. And this is the first one in that section. It's called Diary, December 8th, 1963. Jack Zangetti told friends the day after Kennedy's murder, a man named Ruby will kill Oswald tomorrow, and a member of the Frank Sinatra family will be kidnapped, diverting attention from the assassination. 2 weeks later, Frank Sinatra Jr. kidnapped. $240,000 ransom paid. Sinatra offered $1 million, but the kidnappers turned it down. Sinatra's son released unharmed 2 days later. Kidnappers demanded Sinatra call only from payphones. He carried a roll of dimes the whole time, and this became his lifelong habit. Zangetti, who claimed three other men, not Oswald, killed the president, was found floating in Lake Lugert, bullet holes in his chest, December 8th, 1963, already dead 2 weeks. This is called Diary, June 6th, 1964. Guy Bannister, private detective and retired FBI agent whose colleague, Jack Martin, told friends after the assassination that Bannister and David Ferry were involved. Ferry's role to fly assassin out of Texas, which triggered District Attorney Jim Garrison's investigation, leading to the only criminal indictments in the assassination. 1 week before he died, Bannister told New Orleans Naval Intelligence Director Guy Johnson, "If I'm dead in a week, no matter what the circumstances look like, it won't be from natural causes." Bannister dead of heart attack, June 6th, 1964, the coroner ruled, but former Bannister employees Alan Campbell and Delphine Robert claimed Bannister shot. Garrison biographer Joan Mellon describes the fatal heart attack. "There was blood on the walls." In Oswald's diary, he doesn't say much about the birth of their first child, June, but I needed that in the poem. So I worked a little bit from the diary and extrapolated the rest. And this is called Baby June. "Dice thrown behind a door. Lingering. The time comes. A presence. Snow. There's no taxi. Wedged like glass in the bus. Leave her in care of nurses and leave to go to work. Days of cold Russian winter, but we feel fine. Constellations, stories in the sky. The disappearing world is full of them. A mother is a city. It foams at the mouth. We both wanted a boy. Marina feels well. Baby girl, okay. The balcony by lamplight on green table. She is stout. The evening crackles. Russian custom. They make me wait 10 days to see her. Dear Marina, you and I are completely ready. What do you need? Can you walk? Is June still red?"
The poetry of Tony Trujillo. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thanks for having me, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM, WESA.